I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. Ahead, Pennsylvania's waterfronts are becoming more recreational, but that doesn't mean industry is dead. First, a third person has pleaded guilty in connection to a decade-long con centered on kidnapping mentally disabled people and stealing their Social Security benefits. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, the decision came today during a change of plea hearing in federal court.
Linda Weston is expected to serve life in prison for her role in a plot that crossed state lines and claimed two lives. The charges against the 55-year-old include murder, kidnapping, racketeering conspiracy, and theft of government services. Before the hearing, Weston had faced the death penalty. Under her plea agreement, that's now off the table, says her lawyer, Patricia McKinney.
This was the big resolution today, and we're just grateful to the government that they saw this from a justice point of view and closure, not just for Ms. Weston, but all of the victims in the case.
Back in 2011, police discovered four captives inside a squalid Northeast Philadelphia sub-basement named the Tacony Dungeon. Just before she was set to go on trial in state court in 2013, the feds indicted Weston. Assistant U.S. Attorney Faith Taylor says the victims were dirty and malnourished and that the room reeked of death.
The police described it as one of the worst scenes they've ever seen, and I think that's accurate based on our investigation.
Other victims were drugged and locked in closets, attics, and in one instance, under a kitchen sink. When the captives were first discovered, Weston was pegged as the ringleader of the operation. Her attorneys now dispute that characterization. Weston left school after fourth grade and had difficulty understanding some of the judge's questions during her change of plea hearing. Two of Weston's co-defendants are still headed for trial. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
A local Alzheimer patient and advocate who was prohibited from attending government meetings and even peer support groups is no longer banned. WHYY's Jessica McDonald reports he ran into trouble after his written comments were interpreted as a security risk.
After months of phone calls and most recently debate over the meaning of a letter from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, Michael Ellenbogen is declaring victory.
The bottom line is I'm happy. I can go, and that's the whole point of it.
The 57-year-old Alzheimer's patient and activist from Bucks County is back on the listserv of the National Alzheimer's Project Act and can attend meetings in federal buildings. The words that got Ellenbogen in trouble were read aloud for him at a meeting in January.
What do we need to do to get the attention of some people like you? Will it take someone like me to have some sort of shootout like Columbine before someone will take notice? I would not do that, but I am trying to get your attention, and I am failing and dying at the same time.
By late April, HHS had barred Ellenbogen from attending events in person. He was told they viewed him as a security threat. The Alzheimer's Association asked him to stay away, even from peer support groups.
That was the biggest shocker, to be honest with you, because, I mean, here's an organization that is supposedly supposed to support people with dementia, just threw me right under the bus.
The association says it had a responsibility to protect the safety of its members and has now reversed its position. While Ellenbogen is pleased with the final outcome, he says the actions reflect a huge failure of both organizations to understand the very nature of dementia. He hopes to make it to a meeting in D.C. next month. I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
Keystone Crossroads has been reporting on the growing importance of public access to rivers and waterfronts for recreational purposes. But urban waterfronts are still places of business, too. Although the number of mills, factories, and barges using the rivers has decreased, industry still thrives on the water. It's evolving, and actually in some cities, growing again. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhuroff reports.
A riverkeeper named Rob Walters recently took me out on the Monongahela River, about 20 miles away from downtown Pittsburgh. His first mate, a Portuguese water dog named Rio, after the river, squealed with excitement. Directly across the boat ramp is a staging area for barges.
We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, probably about 30 barges full of coal.
As he started downriver, he navigated the barges on the move.
Usually the general rule of thumb is biggest boat wins, so the barges really are the rulers of the river.
Before too long,
there's that smell.
U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works came into view. U.S. Steel says it's the largest coke works in the country.
When we round this bend and you go down to the Clairton Works, it's still my jaw drops every time.
A belt with buckets on it unloaded coal from a barge, carrying it up to a conveyor belt. The majority of what moves in Pittsburgh's rivers is coal. In 2012, almost 26 million tons of it passed through the port. Here's Pennsylvania's Deputy Secretary for Multimodal Transportation, Toby Favre.
Pittsburgh has traditionally been a coal port. It's been dropping in terms of volume over time.
But it's not like port operators are looking for new kayak rental tenants. They're working on a strategic plan to replace the tons of coal with other products. So far, the port has seen increased Marcellus shale-related cargoes like drilling materials and natural gas byproducts. The Coast Guard is considering allowing the movement of fracking waste by barge. The ports are exploring other markets, too. If none of that works, coal's demise could hurt the port of Pittsburgh. But Favre says Philadelphia and Erie are a different story.
Cargo growth is up. Freight growth is up.
The Erie port handles gravel, stone, road salt, sand, and things like locomotives. The port facility sits side by side with other amenities. It's the state's most visual marriage of industrial and recreational opportunities on the water.
They have built a convention center on the bayfront, put in a lot of recreational boat slips, fishing piers, and there's restaurants along the bayfront. It's a great tourist and recreational area, and right beside all of that is a American shipbuilder and the ability to bring in and offload cargo.
In Philadelphia, the ports are a bit more hidden from the main water recreation spots. The ports have seen double-digit tonnage growth for the past 5 years. The region has become a net exporter of energy and is looking to grow. The Philadelphia Regional Port Authority is already looking for new customers.
Revolutionary change is underway at the Port of Philadelphia. With a deeper river channel, new facilities, and additional services, the Port of Philadelphia is expanding and improving.
The planned Southport facility, which will likely focus on containers, is expected to support thousands of new jobs. If the region continues to be an energy hub, there's hope manufacturing firms will establish routes here too. So while all three cities are sprucing up their waterfronts for people to enjoy, they are at the same time working to grow industry on their rivers. There's also a federal program trying to move more freight from congested roads and railroads to the water, something Pennsylvania, with its rail and road connections and proximity to major markets, is well positioned to do. Dennis Rockford, president of the Maritime Exchange for the Delaware River and Bay, says he doesn't see a conflict between the traditional industrial river uses and newer people-focused development.
I think when people are out on the water in sort of a recreational sense, whether it's landside or on the water itself, seeing that commercial shipping activity, the large cargo ships, the container ships, the tugs, the barges, is a part of the ambiance and the attraction of being on a river.
So while Philadelphia moves forward with its new waterfront plans, its old waterfront is far from gone. Irina Zhorov, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. In today's headlines, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow in the dispute over Governor Tom Wolf's 7-month-old moratorium on the death penalty in the state. Wolf has issued reprieves to each death row inmate scheduled for execution. But the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office calls the granting of open-ended reprieves unconstitutional. Wolf's lawyers say the Constitution grants him the power and that Pennsylvania has a long history of reprieves that were not for a limited time or purpose. The case before the Supreme Court centers around the first reprieve Wolf issued this year for death row inmate Terrence Williams, sentenced to death for killing a man in 1984. Sean Nolan is one of the defense lawyers for Williams. He says there's a long history of reprieves in the state.
What we have found is over the past 300 years, there have been multiple reprieves, and that the use of reprieves have not been limited in purpose, as a district attorney is trying to suggest they must be. It's just not accurate.
Wolf has said his moratorium will continue at least until a task force finishes studying the state's death penalty. Six current and former Philadelphia prison guards are facing federal criminal charges after a sting operation uncovered a pipeline for drugs into city jails. The guards are accused of smuggling drugs and phones into the jails to give to inmates. Philadelphia Prison Commissioner Louis Giorla says the prison system asked for assistance after finding phones and drugs in the jails. He adds this is an ongoing investigation and says the prison system is planning to add more video cameras to slow the flood of contraband. Checking the forecast, cloudy with scattered thunderstorms and a low around 71 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, thunderstorms likely with a high around 82. Tomorrow night, more rain with a low around 63 degrees. Friday, partly cloudy with a high around 84. And Saturday, partly cloudy with a chance of evening thunderstorms and a high near 83 degrees. It's 92 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia at 6:16. This is WHYY. Still ahead, a new theater collaboration shows Andy Warhol's life after death.
You're playing with traditions. You're playing with high art, clashing with low art in a way that Warhol did. But really, the Beards were drawn to Andy Warhol because we think he's still alive, and more so than he was when he was actually alive.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. Available Light, choreographed by Lucinda Childs, with music by John Adams and set design by Frank Gehry, is a monumental work of art by three modern masters who share a minimalist approach to dance, music, and architecture. A singular experience, created by the luminous score, industrial set, and precise choreography. Available Light is on stage this week only as part of the 2015 Fringe Festival. More info at fringearts.com.
Financial news changes by the very minute. Domestic and global markets are crazy.
China's not about to move away from buying U.S. treasuries.
The European Central Bank wading into the Spanish and Italian government bond market today.
The whole debt ceiling debate made us look dysfunctional. We all know that.
That's okay, though, because we're here. Marketplace. It's the business show for the rest of us. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners to discover how a master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. There's an information session on October 1st at Newman's campus. Details at newman.edu. Newman University's master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder. A low-budget cabaret troupe in Philadelphia has teamed up with the city's highbrow opera company to produce a new show that ends up somewhere in the middle. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the premiere of a hybrid show about Andy Warhol.
This season, Opera Philadelphia will transport its audiences to exotic locations, including a Baroque Paris salon in La Traviata, the Blue Ridge Mountains of the Civil War in Cold Mountain. But this production will transport audiences to a warehouse space in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia. The costumes are made of paper. The set is cardboard.
You're in a warehouse. You're on a warehouse in North American Street. But you are where you are.
That is John Jarbo. He's the director of the Bearded Ladies Cabaret, and he's librettist of Andy, a Popera. It's about Andy Warhol, the godfather of mid-century American pop art. The show will not describe who Warhol was then, rather who he is now.
You're playing with traditions. You're playing with high art, clashing with low art in a way that Warhol did. But really, the Beards were drawn to Andy Warhol because we think he's still alive, and more so than he was when he was actually alive.
Jarbo is talking about social media, about selfies instantly uploaded to Facebook, about tweeting and periscoping and Instagramming your way into a kind of digital avatar removed from your real life, because that's kind of what Warhol did to Marilyn Monroe when he started silkscreening her image over and over after she died. In this scene, there are six Marilyn Monroes, each played by a different cabaret performer, each in a different colored dress. They are not playing Marilyn herself, but rather the image Warhol made in multiples.
You're famous.
I was already famous.
But now you're dead famous. Your heart.
The music of this opera, or rather a popera, is a mixture of opera and cabaret. There are cabaret singers and a chorus of 12 opera singers. Composer Heath Allen wrote the cabaret parts, and another composer, Dan Visconti, wrote the opera parts. And they stay distinct. Allen says the two music traditions are not blended, they're juxtaposed.
This is actually a very much a Warhol-inspired idea, too, the way he would often, for example, print two silkscreen images and just let them lie side by side. Somewhat intertwined, but each with its own integral image. And so I think we're trying to do the same thing, where opera and cabaret exist side by side, but are not mushed.
What about me?
How about me?
You were just a picture of a dead woman. Now you're art.
No!
Opera Philadelphia and the Bearded Ladies Cabaret have been collaborating on this Andy Apopera for over 2 years now. It's a big change for both of them. The small cabaret ensemble devises work as a group, organically, sometimes messy. They use a lot of improvisation. On the other hand, the opera company develops large productions with union singers and schedules worked out years in advance. The director of Opera Philadelphia, David Devan, says by working with the Bearded Ladies, he's not dumbing down opera. He's keeping it nimble into the 21st century.
Is it changing it? Absolutely. At the same time, if we were only doing that and not producing La Traviata, do you know what I mean? Then I could be accused of sort of trying to change opera in totality. I'm not. What we're trying to do is try to offer a range of those experiences.
Opera Philadelphia will open its regular subscription season in October with the classic La Traviata at the Academy of Music on Broad Street. The Andy Warhol Popera premieres as part of the Fringe Festival in a warehouse up in Kensington. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News. Maybe I was just
caught wrong. Pope Francis has made news many times for his outgoing and friendly nature and for statements suggesting he has more liberal attitudes than his predecessors and could be a different kind of pope presiding over a different kind of Catholic church. But is he really? Ahead of the Pope's visit to Philadelphia, we turn to Catholic writer and commentator Austin Ivory, author of a biography of Pope Francis called The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Austin, thanks for speaking with us.
Nice to be with you, Brad.
So what do you mean when you say Francis is a radical pope?
Well, he's a radical in the sense that he belongs to a tradition of Catholic reform, going back to his hero, St. Francis of Assisi, which is all about focusing the church on its essential mission, which is to offer the saving love of Jesus Christ to the world. But importantly, without the distractions or the obstacles of wealth, power, status, and that kind of thing. So he's radical in the sense that there's a focus and a simplicity in what he's doing and in what he wants the church to do. And he's unafraid to challenge interests which oppose that.
He's not the first reform-minded pope, but he is different from the last few that we've seen, correct?
Well, I think, you know, the tradition of Catholic reform is occasionally you will get a pope who comes along who comes from outside the existing structures. These are prophetic figures who are often quite critical of the way things are done, and they get given the keys of St. Peter. And this is really what happened in the case of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, is that, you know, he was very much somebody who didn't like to be in Rome. He wasn't part of the Vatican structure. He was a bishop in Buenos Aires in Argentina, but he was seen as the man who was capable of reforming the Vatican and making the church more missionary in a moment, let's face it, of crisis for the Catholic Church. I believe he's a great reformer, not just because of that, but because he has incredible leadership abilities. He's an extraordinarily capable governor, a fearless leader who knows how to get things done. And he's already, in the very short time he's been in the pontificate, put in place reforms which I think actually are going to have a lasting impact on the church for many years to come, even though this will be a short papacy, as he himself says, for reasons, of course, of his age. That doesn't mean that it won't have a profound effect. There have been short papacies in the past which have also had a very far-reaching effect. The real revolution of this pope is he's put mission and mercy right at the forefront of what of the church's offer to the world. And what's happening is in his gestures, in his words, in the things that he said and done, he is modeling, of course, Jesus. And that is disconcerting for a lot of people. But it's awakening also a memory, I think, in contemporary Western society, of that people are recognizing that unconditional love which Jesus had is what they see in this pope. And they really believe it. There's an integrity there. There's a warmth and a lovingness in him, which I think people are responding to.
The Pope grew up in Argentina at an interesting time. He's a Jesuit. How does his background influence his religious leadership?
Well, he's always been, from the very beginning, a natural leader. That was spotted early on in him when he was a Jesuit. He was only 36 when he was made the head of the Jesuits in Argentina at a time of crisis. And as I found in my biography, actually at particular moments in his life when institutions are in crisis, he somehow always gets, you know, given a leadership position, almost coming out of nowhere. I mean, he is naturally a very reticent person. People are surprised by this, but he's naturally introverted. He's not naturally gregarious, and yet steps forward at moments of crisis because he does, people have recognized in him, a formidable intelligence, an enormous capacity for leadership, real leadership skills, and a vision. I mean, he is really a visionary. He himself was born of immigrant parents. His grandparents emigrated with his father in 1929. You know, they came from the north of Italy. They went to Buenos Aires. They could, frankly, easily have come to Chicago or New York or indeed Philadelphia. He's part of the same background, really, that most Americans share. And I think when he comes here, I think people are going to be very struck by the fact, you know, sure, he's a Latin American, but, you know, he's firstly the first pope born in the New World. And he will understand and relate to the background of most Americans. He grew up in a well-educated but poor background, and he's never lost those roots. He's always avoided pretension of any sort. He's always wanted to be with the people rather than with the wealthy and the intellectuals, and I think that's a conscious choice that he thinks Jesus made, and he emulates that. And so his leadership has always been exerted on behalf of the least, on behalf of the excluded, and that's where he's also rooting the papacy.
Austin Ivory is author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks very much.
And if you think you know the Pope as well as his biographer, we have a challenge for you. You can test your knowledge and maybe learn something with our trivia quiz at whyy.org/popeinphilly. It's part of our special coverage of Pope Francis's historic visit. Finally this evening, despite the growing local foods movement and the efforts of First Lady Michelle Obama, snack foods remain high on the list for many Americans. That was demonstrated this week as USA Today and 10best.com released the latest result in their Readers' Choice Awards to pick the top 10 best food factory tours in the U.S. Salty and sweet choices helped Pennsylvania claim two of the top spots. Perennial favorite Hershey's Chocolate World placed fourth, and Chester County's Hers Snack Food Factory came in at number one. Perhaps that's not surprising, since according to the Northern Plains Potato Growers Association, the average American eats over 4 pounds of potato chips every year. That adds up to a total of 1.5 billion pounds of chips. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help tonight from Brett Rader. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.